Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
You may have seen the pictures online or on the Today Show or wherever. The headline is usually something like, "Little girl mistakes bride for princess from her favorite storybook." And it's easy to see why they went viral. They are crazy cute.
She looks surprised. I don't have my white dress on this time. Hi. How are you?
Good.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. And we joined the bride, the mother, and the daughter for a little reunion in front of the Hotel Ballard.
Remember the princess? I told you she'd be not in her princess clothes. Because princesses only really wear their princess clothes on the weekends, because it's a lot of dry cleaning.
Shandice Robertson was celebrating her wedding day last winter in full white dress on the sidewalk.
We knew we wanted to take pictures outside, and as we're walking down the street, we see Kelsey and her daughter, and then she had her book in her hand.
She had been carrying around The Women in White by Wilkie Collins, which looks like there's a lady in a princess outfit on the cover, and so she was kind of putting two and two together.
And then Kelsey said she thinks you're the lady on the cover of her book.
How would you describe her face?
When you see a celebrity and someone that you've been staring at a picture of, I mean, it was just like one of those like, whoa. Like, it was a lovely moment. You didn't have to take time out of your wedding to do that. And I think you picked her up, and we definitely got some mud on the dress. And I'm sitting there like, oh, no. But you gave her a flower, which was so lovely, and she carried it around for the next 30 minutes until we lost it in Fred Meyer.
It was probably the sweetest part of our wedding. So the dancing, the cake, the socializing, that was all great. But this was so organic. And we were talking about it for weeks afterward.
So this seems like it could have easily been one of these moments that you remember, and maybe it's in your photo album, and it's just an appendix to obviously a very memorable and important day that you're going to remember for the rest of your life. But instead of just kind of getting filed away somewhere, this became a bigger deal in your lives. Do you want to describe what happened?
Yeah, so my husband Scott posted the photo on Imgur with the caption that said, "This little girl thinks my wife is the princess from her book." Then it started to spread, I think, like wildfire.
A daycare teacher of ours stopped my husband, was like, "Did you guys run into a wedding in Ballard or something in February?" Like, at some point when it was gloomy, and we were like, "Well, yeah, why?" And she's like, "So there's pictures of your daughter on the internet." And was like, "Oh, well, that's kind of cool." But then it like went crazy.
We're watching the views grow, like 300 views, 120,000 views. Like, it was a little, unreal.
And then it was the second day where it went, like, abroad. And so we were getting media requests from, like, India, from Germany. It happened when I think people were looking for a lot of positivity.
What do you mean by that?
I think we're at a very interesting time when people can get really negative and vitriolic, not only in real life, but also on the internet. And so it was just a reminder that humanity is lovely and we can all be wonderful if we make that choice. Shandice chose to come up to us and take this moment with my daughter, which lasted 5 minutes, and it was beautiful. It was very nice and heartwarming. And I don't think we see that very much. And we just remember that, I don't know, we're humans and we can be like that if we choose to.
The innocence of seeing the world through a child's eyes. Clearly the lady on the front of her book is Caucasian, white lady, and then I am African-American bride, and she didn't even see that. She just saw this as a princess, you know. The color of my skin didn't matter, and I think there's definitely a lesson in that.
Next time we see you, I do request a princess outfit.
Keep up, Shandice.
I'm okay with that.
Again, yeah. Use it again.
I'm okay with putting my wedding dress on again, for sure.
There's something about royalty that draws us, even long after we've stopped going to preschool in a tiara. And that's our theme today, from a legendary Seattleite with a most regal name to a very real princess in a North End neighborhood. But next, onto a story about his royal badness, Prince. Robbie Luna is a carpenter in Seattle, but by night he portrays the role of Prince in the Prince cover band Purple Mane. When Prince died, Purple Mane decided it had a responsibility to honor the artist's legacy.
We take his music seriously, but it took on a different meaning now. It's like, if we're going to perform his music, we have to do it right. We can't half-ass Prince.
But Robbie would soon come to find that his Prince act had an even deeper impact than he'd imagined. It came from a chance encounter during his day job. Producers Warren Langford and Alex Cartwright bring us that story. And because of the sensitive subject matter, some of the names have been changed. Here's Warren.
So Robbie is a carpenter, and one day he's called to fix some windows on a Seattle apartment building.
I was doing some banging, and it was probably, 10 in the morning, and I noticed a woman go out the front door to the front lawn and look up at me. I had the impression of her as a no-nonsense professional woman. I assumed that she's gonna let me have it for making all this noise up here. I said, oh, great. And then I heard the doorbell ring. She rang the door to the apartment above where I was working. And I was like, okay, I'll go down and calm her.
The woman, who introduces herself as Carmen, studies his face and after a second asks Robbie if he was in a band.
I was a little perplexed as to how she recognized me. I had tools and whatnot. I did not look anything like Prince, I can guarantee. And I said, yes, I play in this Prince cover band, Purple Mane. And then she got she kind of stepped back and was like, put her hand over her heart and said, wow, I've seen you perform. And I remember you. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'm always happy to meet a fan. And then things took a turn. I did not expect what was coming next.
Carmen told Robbie that she had shared that apartment with her fiancé, Mark. The two of them met when Mark was a lawyer and Carmen had gotten a job cleaning for him.
What I found really attractive about him when I met him was the fact that despite his social status, he was able to treat the help as equals. And I later on learned that he actually came from nothing and turned things around for himself. He was unhappy in his marriage, and I was unhappy in my own. And we basically chose to change our unhappy lives and pursue happier ones. It's very painful, but there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And music was a big thing in our relationship. He played music, I sang, and it was what companionship is supposed to look like.
And that brings us to right now. Carmen is standing face to face with this carpenter in her apartment building.
Before in my life, I had never believed in woo-woo stuff. But for some reason, that whole week was very woo-woo in every way. Mark had taken his own life a week before. And I had his body, we had a viewing, and I had a moment with him alone, and I just had a silly moment where I chose to have Purple Rain in the background, and just kind of held his hand there for a bit, listening to Purple Rain, and then I see Robbie in the building, and I think, this guy looks awfully familiar, and I don't know where I've seen him before, and I can't stop thinking about it, and I obsess over it, and eventually it hits me that he's the guy from Purple Mane,
And Mark and I had gone to that show and we'd had a blast. And we'd thought he was so... The whole band, I mean, they were wonderful, all of them. And Mark and I had been talking about going to see them again whenever they were around. And so I thought, gosh, this is Mark trying to communicate something to me. He sent Robbie to the building.
And then she tells me this story about Mark taking his life in this apartment just a week prior to me being there. And I didn't know what to do, but I gave her a hug. I'm so sorry. Wow. Where do you go from there? So I was stammering like I am now. And then she, I think she had a great solution to end this awkward exchange.
I already had the plan. Yeah, and he was like, I don't mean to sound woo-woo, and I'm the most rational person. But the minute that I saw him and recognized him, it was clear to me that this was Mark's plan.
So I walk into the apartment, and the first thing I notice is a ginormous flower bouquet. It was like, oh wow, this is fresh, this just happened. And so it kind of got real, like, oh. So what I was feeling was just very, I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm not a person who feels energy, like there's a weird vibe, man, but I felt it. It was very quiet. It was just her and I. And she brought me Mark's guitar from a different room, and I tuned it up the best I could and kind of gave a cleared the throat a little bit and played Purple Rain.
It's at this point that Carmen took out her phone and started filming. Yeah.
I think I made it into the second verse and I heard a knock at the door. As a performer, if you have a hiccup, you keep going. So I kept playing. And the person kept knocking. And finally, I just said,
come on in.
Such a shame our friendship had to end.
Hi, sorry. It's okay.
Purple Rain.
Purple Rain, Purple Rain.
So at the door was my uncle, who had come from a different country to help me deal with the aftermath.
I just decide to let this strange person into the house while I'm playing.
I was ready to just let it go and not let him in. I figured, you know, if I heard music and nobody was answering, I would just stop.
And I powered through. We powered through. Finished the song and it felt good. And in fact, she told me a bit about her and Mark's relationship and how they planned to get married. And she did say that she hadn't even smiled that whole week leading up to this. She'd been so sad, understandably, and I was so happy that I could bring her a little bit of happiness in all this sorrow.
It was huge to me because it felt as if Mark had found a way to say goodbye to me. And so I felt this huge happiness, joy mixed with sadness, kind of brought me back down to earth, back down to how life is really worth living. And I'm really appreciative of the fact that he was willing, that Robbie was willing to do this for me, because I realized that it was just so random and other people might not have been so open to doing that.
That story from producers Alex Cartwright and Warren Langford, a version of it first appeared on their podcast, Personal Effects. Welcome back to Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about royalty. When your parents name you royal, that's got to be hard to live up to. But legendary Seattle sports writer Royal Broham certainly did. He started at the Post-Intelligencer in 1910, and he wrote there until his death in 1978. So that's pre-World War I through Jimmy Carter. And he also played an important supporting role in the story of the 1936 University of Washington crew team, which is immortalized in the bestseller Boys in the Boat. Author Daniel James Brown joined us to talk about it, starting with a passage from his book.
His opinion, his connections, and his tenacity were so well regarded that he was quickly becoming something of a ringmaster of civic life in Seattle, sought out by grandees of all stripes, politicians, star athletes, university presidents, fight promoters, coaches, even bookies. But above all, Broham was a masterful promoter. Part poet, part P.T. Barnum, Emmett Watson, another legendary Seattle scribe, called him. What he wanted to promote, above all else, was Seattle. He wanted to transform the world's view of his gray, sleepy, logging, and fishing town into something far grander and more sophisticated.
Why was it so important to Royal Broham to promote Seattle and publicize it?
You know, I think he, like a lot of people in the 1920s and 30s, felt that Seattle just wasn't really getting its due respect in the world. A lot of Easterners literally didn't know where Seattle was on a map. And it became kind of a quest for Broham to put Seattle on the map. And one of the ways he could do that was by promoting local sports. And at the time, the Huskies were a very good football team. But beyond that, there wasn't a continuing sports story in Seattle that he could use, except for the crew program at UW. And so he became very, very interested early on in what the coaches at UW were doing.
Why do you think he made that connection between the sport of rowing and respectability for the city?
Rowing was, in those days particularly, still seen as a gentleman's sport, as sort of an elite sport, as a classy sport. And by coming out of Seattle with a rowing program that could compete with the Ivy League schools in the East, he was giving Seattle that sort of patina, that sort of endorsement of a place that has class. It's not just a fishing town. It's not just a mill town. We are world class out here.
So when did it become apparent to Royal Broham that these rowing crews of 1935 and 36 were going to be something special, not just another run-of-the-mill team?
Broham developed an interest early on in not just in the crew program, but with a particular bunch of kids at the crew program. He became very interested in what in 1935 was the sophomore boat. This was the boat that had Joe Rance and some of what would eventually become the Olympic crew in it. And he really thought they were the team, the crew that ultimately might be able to go to Berlin and represent not just Seattle, but the country in the Olympics. And so he focused on this particular bunch of guys, and he followed them for the next several years and promoted them strongly in his column.
He was quite partisan for them.
He was quite partisan for this particular crew, yeah. I think he liked and I think he cultivated the notion that these were not just college kids that happened to come from a campus out in the West, but these were kids with a working class background, kids who in some cases had in fact worked in the woods or in mills. I think he thought that was a helpful part of the narrative, and absolutely, I think he stoked that.
Yeah. So Rome followed this team as they sort of notched win after win, high-profile victories over California and then over the Eastern schools in the national championships, all the way up until the Olympic trials, in which in dramatic fashion they became the U.S. Olympic crew team.
Right.
And then the story took kind of a turn when they found out that it wasn't going to be so simple to get themselves over to Germany, and Brougham had a role in that. How
right.
did that play out?
So what happened is just a couple of hours after these kids from UW won the right to be the U.S. Olympic team, a guy named Henry Penn Burke from Pennsylvania Athletic Club came to him and said, well, great, congratulations on winning the berth to the Olympics. But he told Al Ulbrichtsen, the coach, I hope you understand your boys are going to have to pay their own way to Berlin. And Ulbrichtsen, that was the first Ulbrichtsen had heard about it. He assumed the Olympic Committee would be paying their way. The university didn't have any funds to send them. These kids didn't have two nickels to rub together. So it was a huge problem. So that night, Royal Brougham and Al Ulbrichtsen in particular, and other people associated with the crew, started making phone calls back here to Seattle. And the phones rang deep into the night. And by the next morning, steering committees had been formed. And by that afternoon, there were dozens and dozens of people out on the street corner selling these little paper badges for 50 cents to raise funds. Royal Brougham wrote a column about it. Over about 48 hours, they raised $5,000 in the middle of the Great Depression, which, of course, was a lot of money then.
So they managed to do it. They booked berth on a steamer or whatever and, mm-hmm. and went across the Atlantic to, yeah. to Hitler's Germany. And there they were at the 1936 Olympics. Brougham went along to cover it. The Germans dominated the rowing events from, you know, top to bottom almost. Mm-hmm. And then the culmination was the eight-man
exactly.
crew, which in which the Huskies were competing for the United States.
Switzerland, Hungary, Great Britain, America, Italy, and Germany are in the final.
So the guys from UW had a lot going against them the day of the gold medal race. Don Hume, their stroke oar, was very, very ill with some kind of respiratory infection, was running a high fever. The weather was windy, and despite having turned in the best qualifying time, the University of Washington, the USA team, was assigned lane six out in the windiest part of the race course. Because it was so windy out there, they didn't hear when the start of the race was called. And so they didn't know it had begun until they saw the British boat just to their left lurch forward. So they rowed hard, but 1,000 meters down the race course, halfway through the race, they and the Brits were tied for dead last.
Halfway, Italy still lead, but America on the far side have passed Great Britain. And here on the left, coming up, hand over fist on Italy, of Germany.
At the last possible moment, Don Hume suddenly snaps his head up, opens his eyes wide, and starts rowing just absolutely beautifully. And the boats begin to gain back on the leaders, who at that point are Italy and Germany out front. Just about 100 meters before the finish line, they catch the Germans and the Italians. But for that last 100 meters, the bows go back and forth. It's just, you know, nip and tuck those last 100 meters or so. The last perhaps 10 meters, the Huskies put on one final surge and sort of thrust the bow of the Husky Clipper across the finish line, and they win that gold medal by 6/10 of a second.
America! Italien. Dritter, Deutschland.
Just in front, the win by a yard. Italy second, Germany third.
Amazing. And so an incredible story for a guy like Royal Broome to write. I mean, this must be what he's in it for. So how did he tackle that job, and what happened?
So we'll never know for sure. We know that he did in fact rush back to the press room and pound out a story, and it must have been the story of his life because he'd worked at it for so long. What he didn't know when he dispatched the paper back, the article back to Seattle, was that there was a strike going on, a newspaper strike going on here in Seattle. The PI was out on strike, and so that article was never published. And as far as I know, has never actually seen print.
Isn't that a heartbreaker?
It is. It's terrible. And I would love to see it. I mean, this was absolutely the moment of glory. And we are not quite sure how he put it into prose.
And as we said at the beginning, I mean, one of Broome's passions was to publicize and really put Seattle on the map and brush up its reputation. And he saw this crew story as being part of that, an asset for that project. So I wondered to what extent you think he and they succeeded.
I think he did succeed. I think that it was the beginning of a trend towards greater recognition of Seattle and of the West Coast, in fact, as important players in not just the world of crew, but the world of sports, and a place that you had to pay attention to. Seattle still had a lot to go through. Of course, we did have Boeing here, and Boeing would become enormously important in just a few years with the beginning of World War II, and that certainly put Seattle on the map in a different way. But I think that there was a beginning there. I think this story really does represent sort of a first step in that direction.
Well, Daniel James Brown is the author of Boys in the Boat, number one bestseller, and thank you so much for coming in to talk about Royal Broome's role.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It's stories of royalty this week on Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. In the Greenwood neighborhood of Seattle, tucked among the bungalows, sits an ornate yellow and red building. On one side flies the American flag, and on the other flies what's called the Dharma flag. This monastery is one of the most important sites in the world for one of the four major traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, the Sakya school. And it houses a genuine princess. Her Eminence Dagmo Kusho Sakya is one of the most prominent female lamas in Tibetan Buddhism, and she's the widow of the man who once held the Sakya throne. She goes by Dagmola to her friends, and the story of how she came to be here starts in the 1930s and 40s in rural eastern Tibet.
My family, whole family, are very, very strong background Buddhists. Of course, Tibetans are all Buddhist. And I was introduced when I was 4 years old. I was sent with a study a little bit in the, with the monks.
It wasn't that common for girls to take the same kind of religious education as boys. But you had this beloved great uncle who was a respected lama. And you write that he told you that you're going to be different. You're going to not be like the other girls. You're not going to be just like a housewife. Do you know what he might have seen in you?
Yes. Yes. When I was young, I had a very interesting dreams and imaginations. Every time I tell my great uncle, and he listens, I think he knows exactly.
He saw something special in those visions.
That I'm going to live alone and maybe married with a Sakya lineage, produce their sons, maybe help with all other sentient beings. Well, I'll try anyway.
To help with all other sentient beings, the highest calling of a devout Buddhist. So Dagmola went to school with the boys, spending days in the monastery learning the Dharma. As a teenager, she set out with her family on a religious pilgrimage to Sakya, Tibet, the seat of the Sakya school of Buddhism. And there, she met a prince, the son of the Sakya throne holder, Jigdal Dagochen Sakya. They courted and married and prepared for a life together. But soon things changed in Tibet with the Chinese invasion in 1959. Suddenly, soldiers were everywhere, and the Sakya Buddhist faced a choice, to stay under Chinese rule or risk an escape.
If you stayed in Tibet, maybe not that bad, maybe not practice religion. So anyway...
Oh, let me ask you to pause there. You're saying you might have been safer if you stayed in Tibet, but that would be at the cost of being able to practice.
Right.
Why was that a choice you weren't willing to make?
We don't want to lose our religion. We know that. That's our life.
So they decided to leave Tibet, to flee to neighboring Bhutan and then to India, where the Dalai Lama was leading a huge community of Tibetan refugees.
When we left from Tibet, we left with a horse and mules. But in some of the mountainside, you really cannot ride so much. It was snow is very, very high. But walking and riding horse.
How difficult was that journey?
If I tell you, don't even believe. It was very difficult. Only one pair of shoes and go walking. That's why I ruined my old knee. And snow... what do you call it? Sun comes in snow. We all group burned, sunburned. Aye.
Oh, like snow blindness.
Not only that, we're scared. We have to leave fast because Chinese might come afterward.
What do you remember about how it felt to you?
Well, only that I never thought that we're going to leave forever. Always maybe for temporary, come back.
In India, they were contacted by a professor from the University of Washington. Terrell Wiley had founded the Tibetan Studies Program at UW, and he had the idea of bringing Tibetan scholars to Seattle. He found funding and reached Dagmo's family, and soon they found themselves in a rainy place they'd never heard of, trying to rebuild.
When we first came here, like 3 years, Grant, I said, this is my second home. My first home is in Tibet still. But then I went in 1986 in Tibet. I saw there's no my home. So this is only home now.
What was it there that you saw that
there
gave you that?
Nothing. It was so destroyed homes and monasteries, monks disrobed. At that time, it's very sad. I almost cried every day because there's nothing like when we were there. It's all... very different. So then I realized there's no home.
So Dagmola's family committed to building a life in Seattle. Her husband established a Buddhist center in North Seattle, which quickly grew into this monastery. They raised their 5 sons in the Sakya tradition, but none of them went into the family business. Instead, they became lawyers and executives. So that left no obvious person to carry on the Sakya lineage and hold its throne. That is, until the grandkids were born. 3 of Dagmola's grandkids showed aptitude for the lessons of Buddhism. And so, as young boys, as early as age 4, they were sent to Nepal and India to study Buddhism full-time, preparing one day to take the Sakya throne.
So what is life like for your grandsons who are studying there?
Very, very busy. I can't even call this. Don't call me this. The teacher's wonderful and straight, hour to hour. They study Tibetan and debate, all kind of just hour to hour. So I realized how busy, how wonderful they are doing.
What role will they have in Sakya Buddhism when they move along in their studies and get older?
In the Tibetan Buddhism, some are reincarnated, like Dalai Lama is 14th Dalai Lama. But it's unlike the Sakya, hereditary. It's over almost close to 2,000 years way back, descended from celestial being. And that the lineage is unbroken now. We decided that every 3 years, take a turn to such a throne holder.
Every 3 years you take turns holding the throne?
All the queen who are qualified. they will be qualified out. That's why they study now.
And so it'll be, they're all cousins, right? So it'll be one cousin to cousin to cousin.
One family, yes.
Her Eminence Dagmo Kusho Sakya of the Sakya Monastery here in the Greenwood neighborhood in Seattle. Thank you so, so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories of royalty. So normally on the radio, we try to keep things pretty clear and concise. So when somebody has a really long title, you know, like Executive Vice President for Strategy of whatever organization, we tend to abbreviate things. But with this next guy, I'm going to go ahead and give you the full version.
It's Most Worshipful Grandmaster Julius W. Brown, Jr.
And what is the abbreviation for that?
Most Worshipful. But Grandmaster Brown or Brother Brown, either of those work.
Brother Brown gets that title because he's a leader in the Freemasons, a worldwide fraternity complete with secret symbols and rituals. It's been around for centuries. Specifically, Brown is the Most Worshipful Grandmaster of the Prince Hall Grand Lodges of Washington, which is a traditionally African-American branch of Freemasonry. They celebrate the legacy of free black men, including a guy named Prince Hall, who went all the way to the King of England to get formal acceptance into the Freemasons. This was back in the days of the Revolutionary War.
They were soldiers. They made them Masons, but they didn't give them the opportunity to create a lodge and make other Masons. So what Prince Hall and the other guys did was they pulled their money together and they chartered a boat to England. And they petitioned the king for a charter, which at that time had to come from the Grand Lodge of England. And until this day, if you're not recognized by the Grand Lodge of England, then we call you bogus.
Julius is from Philadelphia. The army brought him out to the Northwest, and he never left. But he grew up with the Prince Hall Freemasons. They were a huge part of his community, building playgrounds, paying for sports uniforms. His dad, his uncles, all the men he knew were in the organization.
Well, through a kid's eyes, we thought that they were the businessmen who ran the world because they all wore black suits and had briefcases. So, you know, you couldn't tell me that my dad wasn't the mayor of Philadelphia at the time and that the other guys weren't the city council. So to me, it looked established, and it gave me that ideology of wanting to be a part of a brotherhood like these guys were.
Do you remember when you first learned about Prince Hall Masonry and what set it apart from other Grand Lodges?
I learned about Prince Hall through my father and my uncles. When I asked my father about it, he told me I wasn't ready to become a Mason. But
how old were you?
21.
Oh, yeah. So you were a full grown-up.
Yeah, I was grown with kids, so my father said I wasn't ready.
You think he was right?
At the time, somewhat, yes. Yes. But I think Masonry grounded me. You know, I'm the baby of five. I've always been the wild child, the one who could, you know, not care about anything because I always had somebody to have my back. And I think Masonry gave me a grounding. It settled me down a lot better than I would have without it.
It sounds like there's a pretty mixed record of Prince Hall Lodges being accepted both by other, you know, white lodges and kind of society a little bit writ large. How has that been here in this region historically?
Washington is one of the leaders in the open door policy. One of the grand masters of the Washington Mainstream Lodge has said that he wanted to open the doors. This was 1920, I think it was, what Grand Lodge of Washington voted on it and said, yes, let's do it. Well, other white Grand Lodges from other states said if they did that, that they would break off ties or what we call not communicate or not recognize you as Masons. So the Grand Lodge out of session, instead of opening doors, they said they put a hold on it for that time. And that Grand Master told them that when he dies, he did not want a Masonic emblem or a Masonic service unless they had open door policy with the African American Prince Hall Grand Lodge. So in other words, it was, don't even bury me as a Mason until we recognize our brothers in the Prince Hall Grand Lodge. So we were one of the first leading areas to go in that direction. There are still Grand Lodges in Texas and Alabama who, you know, that'll never happen.
They're still not recognized.
Never. It'll happen one day. It hasn't happened yet.
So who can become a member of the Prince Hall Lodge here in Washington?
Anybody.
Any man?
As long as you're 18 or over.
So could a white man become a member?
Yes, we have plenty of white members. Interesting enough, I had a soldier. He hounded me for about 3 months, and he was white. And his uncle was a Main Street Mason. And he said he had talked to his uncle, and his uncle told him all about the differences between Prince Hall and Main Street. And he decided that he wanted to be Prince Hall. And he hounded me, and I said, are you sure you want to be Prince Hall? He said, yeah. And I asked him why, and he said, because Prince Hall has never discriminated. And I said, wow. So I finally gave him a petition. I make him work for it, though.
Do you accept gay members?
Yes. Yes, we have no discrimination at all.
Trans members?
We haven't had any. That's a subject that we just discussed at our Conference of Grandmasters. Part of Masonic law is that you, and it's written in our rituals, you have to be a man, freeborn, yada, yada, yada. But we're discussing that because we're in a different time now. So I don't see why we would discriminate on transgender.
So let's talk a little bit more about how it's been part of your life. Can you think of an example, like a story that you can tell of a time in your life, maybe where there was something difficult or whatever, that being a member of the Prince Hall Lodge helped you through something or gave you some insight or was important to you?
Being a Mason has provided me sometimes with the opportunities and assistance that normally I wouldn't have gotten. I've been in places where I missed my flight. I was low in cash. And USO, you know, was overpopulated. And so, you know, I had a guy who was a Mason who recognized my ring, and he bought me dinner, bought me drinks, you know, kind of made me feel comfortable for that time that I had to wait 6 hours for the next flight.
So what's that like when you're out and about and maybe you do need help, like that situation at the airport, or maybe you're just out for whatever reason and you come across a brother that you don't know? What's that connection like?
To me, it's like if we went to the same elementary school, that's a grounding point. So you don't even have to know me. You just know that we went to the same elementary school and we can build from there. It's the same with Masonry. When we kneel at that altar, we take our obligations. We know that every other person that we meet did the same.
I know a lot of fraternal organizations are going through a big demographic and membership crisis. Their membership is aging. It's getting smaller. Young people aren't coming in. Is that something that you guys are experiencing, and how are you dealing with it?
We were experiencing it in huge, huge numbers until Dan Brown's books became movies.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That made a big difference.
Oh, yeah. The Da Vinci Code and the Dan Brown series really turned the corner for us and made young men take notice and say, Masons run the world again, so, which is not true. But I think that whole mystique, it encaptured a lot of the young men and turned it around. But I blame that also on Masons. It's a generational thing. But as I said in our grand session in July, attrition happens to most organizations. It's happened to Masonry before. It's going to happen to Masonry again. But Masonry's been around for over 400 years, and it's going to be here. So I don't necessarily worry about the attrition, because I believe those who have it in their heart, like I do, will always be there, whether it's 20 people in a room or 10.
You talked about when you were about 21 years old telling your father that you were interested in joining a lodge, and he told you that he didn't think you were ready. So can you tell me a little bit more about what it was that you think he meant and how you found yourself being ready in later years to join?
Well, my father knew me best, and he knew that I really didn't have the principles and the understanding of what masonry was. I think I wanted to do it because he did it and it looked cool. And a part of being a Mason, when somebody comes to you and say, I want to be a Mason, we go, yeah, sure. And we walk away. My father did that to me. I think it was just because it was the first time I asked. And he knew I was not married. I had two children by my now wife and three children by my now wife. And, you know, he just didn't agree with my lifestyle. So I married my children's mother, cleaned up my lifestyle, stopped running the streets as much as I used to. And I asked my father-in-law to sponsor me. And when I told my father, he was surprised that I had pursued that goal, that I really wanted to be a Mason, and that I wasn't just going to do things to try to please him so that he would sponsor me, that I was going to do whatever it took to become a Mason. And that's what I did.
Was he a little hurt by that? Was he impressed that you went around him?
He was impressed. I'm his namesake.
Well, on that note, Julius Brown is the most worshipful Grand Master of the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Washington. Thank you so much for inviting me in and for telling me more about Prince Hall Freemasonry.
Thank you.
We wrap up the show today with some sad news. If you happened into the Tacoma Nordstrom any time between 1986 and 2013, it's very likely that you saw or heard Juan Perez. Juan played piano there for 27 years. He greeted guests with a familiar tune and a warm smile. Eric Nordstrom, one of the co-presidents of the company, called Perez a fixture and a legend. A few years ago, Juan Perez was diagnosed with a rare type of cancer. And in January, doctors gave him just weeks to live. Still, he kept fighting and he kept playing the piano. His last public performance was July 22nd at the Space Needle. And on Monday, surrounded by his 10 children, Juan Perez died peacefully at age 68. On a week when our show was filled with stories of royalty, we remember a man who was royalty in his own right, as perhaps Tacoma's most beloved entertainer. That's our show for this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt and Jennifer Wing, with help this week from Warren Langford, Alex Cartwright, and Allie Ferguson. Parker Miles Blohm helps with photos and videos, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can find our podcast on iTunes, and you can hear stories from our show on the KNKX and NPR One apps, or on our website at knkx.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. And be sure to tune in next week when our theme is Won't Take No for an Answer. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.